case number 3, 073960, trustees of the Chicago Plastering Pension Trust versus Cork Plastering.
Good morning.
Morning. Good morning. Mr. Garrow?
Yes, I am. My name is Alan Garrow. I represent the defendant appellant Cross Appellee.
You're going to have to speak a little louder.
Sorry.
that doesn't help too much. I mean,
it doesn't really lean into it.
All right.
Well, if you put your mouth.
Listen to that.
Okay.
All right. May it please the court, when I may proceed. Yes. Good morning again. The issues in this appeal are whether the district court erred in admitting an audit report which contains and is predicated on inadmissible hearsay, and whether the court erred in allowing opinion testimony from Gary Gebbes when he was not qualified or presented as an expert witness. On the cross appeal, the issue is whether or not the district court erred in denying any auditor's fees. The defendant, Cork Plastering, was a plastering contractor between the years 93 and 2002. The underlying suit was brought to compel an audit for contributions to certain ERISA and non-ERISA funds. Throughout the audit period, the defendant was operating under certain collective bargaining agreements with three plastering unions, locals 5, 56, and 11. The Cork remitted contributions for all of the hours worked by all of its plasters. The central issue in the underlying case was whether Cork owed contributions to the local five funds for all of the work it performed during the audit period, and whether Cork paid the correct trust funds for each employee. In 2002, the National Labor Relations Board conducted an election amongst Cork's plastering employees to determine whether Local 5 or Local 56 would be the sole bargaining representative, and Local 5 lost that election. In response, they initiated an audit and then subsequently this lawsuit. Now, there were certain assumptions made during the audit. The assumptions were that all of the work done was done within Local 5 territory, which was not true. There was some $17 million worth of work done in non-Local 5 territory. And also an assumption was made that payments that were classified as bonuses were really a subterfuge to avoid paying the union, and that the assumption was made that dues were owed for bonus payments as well. Some other assumptions were that shop and management employees were also subject to fund contributions, and that all work done in Lake County was done by Local 5 members. Now, many of these assumptions were made without factual support, and these assumptions came from representatives of the union, which are hearsay statements on which the auditor, Gary Gebbes, relied in his firm when preparing the report. Now, the audit report, to call it an audit is somewhat a misnomer, because it's predicated on a set of agreed-upon procedures where the union officials and the accountant collaborate, and they lay out the guidelines and the procedures that they will use in compiling the data, and the net result is they prepare a report that purportedly indicates how much is been underpaid to the union funds. The report is not predicated on any objective auditing standards whatsoever, and it is not an audit in the traditional sense, because the audit is not governed by any generally accepted auditing standards. The report itself, which is PX11, is plaintiff's exhibit, the report does not express any kind of an auditing opinion and was clearly prepared for purposes of litigation. In fact, the auditor even testified that it was a collaboration with the client. These assumptions were made, and he engaged in these procedures as directed by his client, compiled the data, and that was the basis for his opinion. The Paddock case is very similar to this one, and it indicates under those circumstances that such a report constitutes inadmissible hearsay.
I really don't understand that objection. I mean, aren't audit reports like this always based on out-of-court statements like payroll records?
Well, the payroll records and contribution sheets that are submitted to the union would be documents that are ordinarily business records, which would constitute an exception to the hearsay rule. I think the problem with this particular audit is that there were certain of these assumptions that were made, and the union officials made these assumptions without a factual basis and then instructed their auditor to engage in these, quote, auditing procedures based on these assumptions. Now, these assumptions are coming from an unknown source, from union officials. The accountant indicated that they were coming from, quote, his client without any further specification. And these assumptions are significant because the assumption was made that all work done during this 9-year period was done in Local 5 territory, which shifted the burden to Cork to prove that that was not the case. And in fact, it was ultimately determined in the trial that some $17 million worth of work was done in territories other than Local 5 territory, which completely undermined one of the major assumptions in this audit report.
But with respect to the assumptions that underlie the audit report, why don't those go to the weight that should be given to the report rather than to its admissibility, which is what Judge Schenker reasoned here?
Right, but the prejudice here is that this report ultimately was used to determine the damages, and the fact that it comes into evidence after it's hearsay and then the court relies on it to make its damage calculations is extremely prejudicial.
You could have your own expert, couldn't you?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Could you have somebody look at that same data and offer a testimony during the trial as to why this was not an appropriate way to calculate the underfunding?
Well, we did have an expert in the trial, and he did testify that certain of the assumptions were unreasonable.
Then why isn't it just like Judge Rovner said? It's a question of which one the judge wants to put more credibility on.
Well, the Paddock Court addressed the same issue and ultimately concluded that the report, because it was based on out-of-court statements and these assumptions that were made by undisclosed union officials, made the entire report unreliable. And to rely on it for any purpose was a violation of the business records exception to the hearsay law, in that the report should not have come in at all, and that relying on it for any purpose would have been inappropriate.
Well, why not? It's a summary of voluminous records, too, isn't it?
That is also addressed under 1006, I believe, on summaries. And a summary would be appropriate if it is based on underlying documents that are otherwise admissible. And in this case, we don't have that. We have a summary based on inadmissible hearsay. So I would acknowledge that there are some documents on which the audit report is based that are business records exception, but there is a large portion of that is not. And the Paddock Court talks about a situation where you have this part of it is inadmissible hearsay and part of it is not, but the proponent of that evidence is the one that needs to clarify for the court what portion of it is inadmissible hearsay and which is not. And in the Paddock Court, they chose to rule that the entire document constitute an inadmissible hearsay.
Didn't they rely on payroll records?
They did, in part.
In part?
In part. They did rely on payroll records and contribution reports, which were filled out monthly and submitted to the unions.
Well, surely those are business records.
Those are business records, but the problem with the hearsay comes in from the out-of-court statements made by union officials to the auditors when they sit down and outline procedures to prepare the report, and the union officials are telling the auditor to make these certain assumptions in the preparation of the report. For example, that all bonuses really are a subterfuge to pay compensation without paying dues, that assume that all the work was done in our territory, that assume that the shop personnel and management employees are also subjected to payments. So the report then was prepared based on those assumptions that were being made by union officials. There's no opportunity to cross-examine the source of that information, and the inherent dangers with the hearsay rule are implicated. So although there are some payroll records and some contribution reports that are used to prepare the document, the entire procedure by which that data was analyzed is being done based on assumptions made that are out-of-court hearsay statements. I have the white light already, so okay. Perhaps I should save my time for a rebuttal. It's amazing how quickly that goes. The compliance audit reports and their summaries are not admissible to prove a deficiency in contributions to labor trust funds under the business records exception to the hearsay rule, and with all due respect, that should not have been allowed. Also, Gary Gebbes, who laid the foundation for the report, admitted that the report was inaccurate, but he could not explain the degree of inaccuracy and did not know certain of the facts and the underpinnings to the report. He was not qualified nor tendered as an expert, and respectfully, he also should not have been to provide opinion testimony as to the amounts purportedly due.
Practically speaking, why does it matter whether or not he was tendered as an expert?
Well, that raises an interesting question, because he then went on, I believe it's on page 94 of the transcript, and stated that he believed the amounts reflected in the report were amounts that were due. And I believe for him to take that position that those sums are...
You mean he gave an expert opinion?
I'm sorry, sir?
You mean he gave an expert opinion?
Yes, sir, he did. On the issues of the cross appeal on the fees, I believe I'd better save that for the rebuttal so I don't run out of time.
That's all right.
If I may. Thank you.
Mr. Huffman-Gotchling?
Yes. May it please the Court. Good morning, Honors. David Huffman-Gotchling, representing the Plasters Local 5 benefit funds and union, the appellees and cross-appellants for this Court and the plaintiffs in the matter below. If I may spend a few minutes in response to the defendant's arguments, then I'll move on to the matters presented by our cross-appeal. Essentially, the defendant's appeal in this matter consists of an objection to two evidentiary rulings by the district court. One, as discussed at the end of my opponent's presentation, was the ruling on their pretrial motion to exclude the testimony of Gary Gebbes as an expert because he had not been disclosed as an expert. And the second was the admission of the audit report into evidence. The district court properly deferred ruling on the motion in limine brought to exclude Mr. Gebbes' testimony because, as we pointed out at the time, Mr. Gebbes had never been tendered as an expert witness. We did not intend to rely upon him for any expert opinion testimony. That proved to be true as the trial unfolded, and in fact, during the course of the trial, I believe there was only one objection made on the grounds that the question called for opinion testimony from Mr. Gebbes. And that was to a question toward the end of his testimony as to what a specific column of figures in his audit report represented, a column labeled amounts due. And the judge properly ruled that, given that Mr. Gebbes designed the procedures according to which the report was created and supervised the creation of the report, he was more than competent to testify as to what a column of figures represented. And in giving an answer to that question, he was not expressing an opinion as to whether or not the report was itself an accurate measure of the contributions owed to the funds. The court properly overruled that objection, and Mr. Gebbes was properly permitted to answer as to simply what a series of figures on a report meant. In fact, on the report itself, the auditors specifically disclaim any opinion as to whether or not the procedures agreed upon between the auditors and the funds, the trustees of the funds, were sufficient for providing an accurate picture of the actual contributions. So that's a matter left for the trial court to decide. As for the report itself, it was properly admitted into evidence. It was a summary of voluminous evidence, as Judge Evans suggested, and Mr. Gebbes, the auditor, was able to lay a proper foundation for its admission. He was able to establish that the underlying documents on which the report was based were themselves admissible. They were, as has been stated today, the defendant's own records.
Is there any significance to the work being done someplace other than the jurisdiction of the area you're talking about?
The significance, yes. In fact, that was one of the key issues contested in the trial court.
Yeah.
That
was there evidence that the work was a good chunk of the work was done someplace else?
Evidence was produced at trial, and the court properly relied on that evidence in rejecting the assumptions made by the auditors at the time they produced the report that all of the work was done in Local 5's jurisdiction, and said, well, given this other evidence that has been produced at trial, I'm not going to accept the audit report at face value. I'm not going to accept the assumptions that the auditors felt they had to make. And I'm going to arrive at my own measure of damages.
How'd he arrive at it?
I'm sorry, how did the court arrive at it?
Yeah.
The court compared...
If he's ignoring the auditor's reports, what's...
I wouldn't say that the court ignored the auditor's report. The court relied on the calculations the auditors did as to how many hours were worked and how many contributions were paid into the Placers Local 5 funds. But then
isn't
it, essentially...
Isn't that inextricably wound up with how much money is being...
The court... Well, because the auditors had assumed that all of the hours should have been paid to my client, the audit report provided a measure of what it would mean for 100% of the work to have been done within the Placers Local 5 jurisdiction. And so instead, the judge looked at the documents showing in which counties, in which union's jurisdiction, sales were made, work was performed, and arrived at a certain percentage, which according
how did he arrive at the certain percentage?
So in other words, let's say showed...
How did he arrive at the certain percentage?
How did the court arrive at the certain percentage?
Well, that's who we're talking about. Yeah, how did the court arrive at it?
The record showed that the records broke down sales by county. And so they might have showed that 30% of the work was done within the local 56 jurisdiction.
Did it show 30% of the work was done?
I don't recall off the top of my head the exact percentages.
Well, the court used some figure. Where did he get the figure?
He got the figure by looking at the total amount of work done and then looking at these records of sales by county. And so the percentage of work that was done in counties outside of the union's jurisdiction.
He made an educated guess.
Correct. He made an assumption, I guess, that the volume of sales per county correlated to the hours.
There are figures available showing exactly how much of the sales were in different counties, aren't there?
Correct. That's what the court relied upon.
He relied on the absolute sales.
Correct.
So he knew exactly how much money there was. Or does he now extrapolate that to some other figure?
He extrapolated that to a conclusion as to how many hours
were
worked by employees.
So he was doing what the auditor should have done.
Well, perhaps.
That's what he was doing, wasn't it? There was no absolute figure there. He had to play games with it to arrive at the figure he did.
That's correct, because the defendant didn't keep records sufficient to allow a precise determination as to which employees worked which hours in which jurisdiction.
But didn't the burden fall on you to establish the reasonableness of the request? I mean, why isn't it reasonable for Judge Schenker to insist on the sort of detail that he was looking for to support the request for audit fees? I mean, isn't that sort of detail necessary to evaluate the reasonableness of a request? I don't know how one's opponent or a court can know whether fees requested are reasonable if one doesn't know what tasks the auditors were performing on a day-to-day basis.
Your Honor, turning to the issue of audit fees, we believe that essentially the approach taken by the auditors of requiring these very specific showings, for which there's no precedent out of this court, and which it had not been the practice in the Northern District of Illinois, to require was an error and was an inappropriate standard to govern an award of audit fees.
I would have thought it was de rigueur for you to seek, you know, to document the background and to do the detailing here. You fault him for adopting, the same standard that is applied for attorney's fees, but, you know, the defendant objected to the audit fees on similar grounds, so you had a chance to respond as to the propriety of such a standard.
I guess there are two issues. One is the standard itself, and one is the opportunity we had to respond, if I may address the first, the standard. It's our position that the approach taken by the court here is almost that of an inspector general trying to root out any inefficiencies that might be lurking in the auditor's billings. When, in fact, the purpose of this relief under Section 502(g)(2) of ERISA is to prevent the financial burden from one non-contributing employer's malfeasance, essentially, from falling on the plan's participants, from falling on other properly contributing employers who are going to be asked to make up any shortfall caused by the funds out of plan assets that the plan is required to spend on auditors in order to collect any delinquencies that are due. We believe that the more appropriate approach in this case would have been simply for the court to have looked, in light of all of the circumstances and facts of this case, as to whether or not the fee seemed reasonable. This is a case where...
Giving any of the detail.
Well, Your Honor, we provided the detail that was available. We provided billings from the auditors, and we provided everything they kept. We provided billings from the auditors showing which auditors from the firm worked on the case on which days and how many hours and fractions of hours each auditor worked on each day. As we made clear to the district court, the auditors didn't keep more detailed records than that. It hasn't been the practice, hasn't been their practice, and it hasn't been the practice in the Northern District to require them to make that kind of showing. But we say that in this case, given the complexity of the audit, given the repeated trips by the auditors out to the workplace to look at records on multiple occasions, given the length and complexity of the report that was produced, given the result obtained, that the auditor's fees are not disproportionate to the ultimate award in this case. They're both proportionate to total judgment in favor of the plan, which exceeded $1 million, and they're proportionate to the attorney's fees awarded in the case. And if the court looks at the other district court cases that we cited as evidence that this has not been the practice to require such a detailed showing, the fees awarded in this case are in line with the fees awarded in those other cases, in the sense that in those four cases, Sullivan v. Brinsky, Laborers Pension Fund versus Midwest Demolition, Moriarty versus Musica, and Dugan versus R.J. Corman, the audit fees awarded were, as a percentage of the total judgment amount, they ranged from, in those cases, from 1.5% to about 16%. In this case, they were about 4% of the total judgment awarded.
We need sentencing guideline type things, I guess.
In those four cases, the audit fees awarded ranged, as a percentage of the attorney's fees awarded in those cases, from about 16% to about 31%. And in this case, the audit fees awarded were just over a quarter of the attorney's fees awarded. So the request of $45,435 is not out of proportion to what has been awarded by district courts in similar cases in this district. And in light of the complexity of this case and the length of time in which the litigation went on, we certainly don't believe that it was unreasonable or disproportionate. And regardless of whether or not the court applied the proper standard, we believe that to have awarded nothing in audit fees, when it's clear from the auditor's testimony and from the volume of work papers produced and the evidence of meticulous work that's that's shown in an examination of those work papers, that to have awarded absolutely nothing in fees was an abuse of the court's discretion. Our concern in the approach that the court has taken is that if essentially what happens is, you know, we'll be holding secondary trials on audit fees where we bring in competing experts saying, well, you know, it would have been reasonable to have four auditors for 3 days looking at this volume of this type of records, and well, I think it would have been reasonable to have three auditors for 2 days looking at this kind of records. That the court's not necessarily well suited to act as a kind of inspector general, making determinations as to how much time it's reasonable for an auditor to spend on a particular task and what kind of background and experience is necessary for an auditor to engage in a certain task, absent some kind of secondary trial on these questions. Now, as to our other argument, the procedural argument, it's our contention that we were denied a reasonable opportunity to present the kinds of evidence that it turned out that the court was looking for. And that's for two reasons. First, because there was no warning in the precedents that this is the kind of standard to which the plaintiffs would be held. And the second is that the court issued somewhat contrary instructions. On the one hand, the court, in a minute order, instructed us to submit a joint statement containing calculations of damages, interest, liquidated damages, and what they called a statement of audit costs.
Forgive me for interrupting, but are you going to want rebuttal on the cross appeal?
I'll conclude my point and we'll waive rebuttal. That's fine. The other order issued at the same time came in the end of the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law, in which the court stated Section 1132G also provides for an award of audit costs, attorney's fees, and costs. The next status date is scheduled. The court will set a schedule for the submission by plaintiffs of materials to allow the court to determine the reasonable audit costs, attorney's fees, and costs, suggesting that the court would allow the plaintiffs to go through the same kind of procedure applicable, the back and forth, exchange of information and materials, and opportunity to flesh out the parties' respective positions that are provided for in the local rules for a petition for attorney's fees. And in fact, the court, by ruling on the parties' joint statement, never gave us the opportunity to go through those steps.
Did you ask for reconsideration on that?
We did, Your Honor, and the court denied it. Thank you, Your Honor.
We have 4 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to be brief. Initially addressing the issue of the audit fees, questions were asked at trial of Mr. Gebbes regarding the claim for auditor's fees in the amount of approximately $45,000. He was asked the question, can you determine roughly how many hours your firm or employees of your firm have worked on this audit? He says yes. And roughly how many hours is represented by that figure? He says, I'd have to get my time records to give you a response, an accurate response. Question, can you give me an estimate? In this case, it's much tougher to do than normal because the rates have been different and we had so much incurred upfront time at the lower rate, I actually would just be guessing. Question, so you don't know how many hours that represents? I can get you that number, but I don't know it offhand. So when Mr. Gebbes was asked about these auditor's fees, he clearly was not able to articulate at all the work that was done, the time that was spent, whether or not the time was reasonable, whether or not the rates were reasonable. And it's not surprising because he testified earlier that he didn't do most of the work on the audit. He just checked some of the calculations at the end, and that was the end of it. There were three other auditors that did the lion's share of the work. One of those three was deposed and yet was not called by the plaintiff in the case. I believe the district court acknowledged that the ERISA statute has a provision that would allow auditor's fees to be awarded in certain circumstances. So with all due respect, there was not a decision made that the audit fees were not awarded as a matter of law. He concluded that there would arguably be an entitlement to the audit fees if the appropriate evidentiary matter had been presented to the court to substantiate those auditor's fees. What he did instead was he exercised his discretion to deny those fees because the evidentiary matter and the basis for that was lacking. He relied on Local Rule 54.3 and indicated that the auditors should be held to the same standards and that there was no such work, no such evidence to be provided, and then to have a second bite at the apple or a third bite at the apple to try to substantiate those fees later is something that is inappropriate. And when you merely submit a bill for $45,000 without substantiation, you run the risk of having those fees denied as within the court's discretion. Again, it would be an abuse of discretion would be the standard of review for that decision, and I'm sure we all know about the dead fish metaphor that Judge Shankier puts in his memorandum opinion.
That actually is Judge Bowers. Should get credit for that.
That's right. it's some language that floats around the circus. So
floats around the circuit only after I said it. But go ahead.
which clearly means that the court's discretion clearly must have been abused in a significant way. And with all due respect, ample opportunity was provided to the plaintiffs to provide evidentiary support for the auditor's fees, and they failed to do it. And the court, within its discretion, determined that those fees should not be awarded. I see my lights on already.
No, you have another minute.
Another minute? Okay. It's amazing how quickly it goes. So, with all due respect, I believe the proper decision was made by Judge Shankier. He wrote quite eloquently in his opinion with regard to that and the rationale.
Eloquence makes up for most law, so,
I'm sorry, sir?
Eloquence makes up for lack of law every time.
Well, I do believe that he accurately stated the law when he said that the ERISA statute does not give them a blank check, and that regardless of whether or not the fees were awarded by statute or by some contractual provision, the reasonableness standard would apply, and you couldn't apply the reasonableness standard in the absence of the evidence. I see now that the final light has come on. So
you can finally go home. Thank you
Thank
very
you.
Much. The case will be taken under advisement.
Thank you.